Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. As Sherlock Holmes remarked, some things are easier to know than to explain. The Russian-British relationship is among them. Despite numerous efforts to mend the historical rivalry, the relationship remained cold and arrogant at best, and poisonous and scheming at worst. What keeps the ill will so entrenched? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ian Proud, a former British diplomat and author of A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy Failed in Russia. Mr. Proud, it's great to talk to you. It's been a long while since I had a pleasure of conversing on air with a British gentleman, let alone a British diplomat. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, let's start with your experiences here in Moscow, which you so humorously describe in your book. Now, you were placed here between 2014 and 2019, which was a pretty intense period, starting with Russia's state fully returning to Crimea, which I have to say the UK once coveted, and all the way to the still mysterious poisoning of Sergei Skripal. So I think it's fair to say that it was the time when the previously politely called relationship turned into a seething hatred. What was it like for you to be in the midst of all of this?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't describe it necessarily as a seething hatred, but it's certainly true that the relationship deteriorated quite significantly during the time that I was in Moscow. Luckily, I was able to travel around Russia quite a lot, and I was able to, I guess, get a more realistic perspective of what ordinary Russians kind of thought about the UK. And there, I think the picture was much more mixed, actually. I got the impression that most Russian people just wanted to get on with their lives and wanted to have good relationships with other countries, including with the UK. And for me and for my family, you know, life in Moscow was, you know, quite privileged as a British diplomat, I have to say. And in most regards, actually, you know, really quite a pleasant experience, especially with young children. But it was work-wise, you know, it was a different matter altogether, of course. That was at times really quite tense, particularly in 2018.
And yet, in the title of your book, you describe yourself as a misfit in Moscow. And given the rising animosity during that period, I assume that it was pretty uncomfortable for, you know, many British diplomats. I wonder if you were indeed a misfit in Moscow, or rather a misfit in the British embassy in Moscow.
Well, I think that's the point I'm trying to make, but a misfit in the British embassy in Moscow would make such a good book title. But that's exactly the point. You're completely right. I mean, my view was much more pragmatic in terms of the need to have a relationship and a dialogue with Russia, despite the difficulties, you know, between our countries, those difficulties which were kind of elevated after events that happened at the start of 2014 that we all know about. And, you know, I was fairly alone amongst British colleagues in having that view throughout my time in Russia.
Let me ask a personal question, because I know that you're a graduate of Solent, a university, which is a good school, but not the elite one. And in the book, you make a point about not having gone to Eton and not coming from the pedigreed family, which I assume didn't prevent or perhaps even aided your curiosity and sort of open-mindedness about the world. I wonder if what you describe as misfit has anything to do with social class, exclusive education, and the entrenched worldviews that are associated with it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I've always been quite comfortable coming from a working class background. I'm really pleased that despite the challenges I faced as a child, I was able to kind of get a university education and join the really prestigious kind of Foreign Office fast stream program. That's never really been a hang-up for me. I think the big advantage I had in life was going up overseas in Germany for the first 9 years of my life. That was a fantastic experience, you know, son of a NATO soldier, But nevertheless, living in a foreign country and having access and experience of totally different cultures, languages to the one I was used to, that for me was a really kind of a good experience. And I think very much the misfit was about not agreeing with UK policy on Russia in its entirety. I still did my job. I still sort of pushed forward UK policy to the best of my abilities. But throughout, I had reservations about the direction of that policy, which continued to this day.
Now, maybe it's a Russian bias, but I think one of the most common words used here in Russia to describe British policy is arrogance, sometimes coupled with ignorance. And I wonder if it's if this arrogance, you know, sort of this moral high ground that the Brits or the British policymakers sometimes assume vis-a-vis our country, whether it is in any way related to their upbringing within those very selective institutions from, you know, from school and all the way to the Foreign Service. Or not?
I don't think so necessarily. I mean, we've had eight foreign secretaries over the last kind of 10 years since the Ukraine crisis started. David Cameron, obviously the current foreign secretary, formerly prime minister, he did go to Eton. But we've had all sorts of different shades, you know, as well in the other kind of seven foreign secretaries. So I don't really think that has necessarily anything to do with it. I think there are just really entrenched views, not just within the political circles, but within the media as well. And I have to say, you know, there are pretty entrenched views in Russia as well, in political circles and in the Russian media about the UK. So very much.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm not sure that's actually the case. And I suggest we start our discussion with, not many people remember about that, but one of the first visits that Vladimir Putin made as the newly elected head of state back in April 2000, actually, you know, 24 years ago, was to the UK. And I think it was specifically meant to convey a goodwill and an effort to mend the historical enmity between our countries, because for centuries we've been scheming against each other in Great Eurasia. And yet one of his first intentions was to sort of mend those ties. And yet 24 years later, we still haven't been able to bury that hatchet. Why do you think it persists? Because I'm sure on the Russian side, there have been efforts to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been efforts on both sides at different times. They've just fallen by the wayside. I think a lack of consistency in leadership on the UK side has been one factor. You know, we've had seven prime ministers during that period that you talk about. You know, we've now had, I've lost count, frankly, of the number of foreign secretaries we've had during that time. So we haven't really had that stability at a political level that has existed on the Russian side. But nevertheless, those moments, you know, when President Putin came to the UK, he came on a state visit, there were still big differences on policy issues, on Iraq, for example, the war in Iraq, on something in Chechnya, for example. But nevertheless, there was still a real commitment on the UK side to really kind of recognize the importance of the relationship with Russia at that time. Likewise, with David Cameron in 2010, you know, he wanted to kind of really have a positive relationship with Russia, and I think that was a sincere desire on his part. And that very much lasted through to, you know, the end of 2013, when he started to become distracted by his attempt to block, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker from being a European Commission president. So, you know, when those efforts have happened on the UK side, they have very much been meaningful. The difficulty was that certainly when Philip Hammond became foreign secretary in 2014, we went very, very hawkish. And then when Theresa May became prime minister in 2016, that really hawkish stance got embedded, you know, at the UK governmental level and hasn't really shifted until this day and continues.
Now, can I ask you about what you just said, that, you know, a number of politicians were sincere in, including Cameron, that they were sincere about hearing Russia's concerns. What exactly you mean by that? Because for Russia, it's not enough just to voice or be heard. Russia wants its security concerns to be recognized and dealt with. I mean, the action is also important, not just, you know, like we are not going to the West to be, you know, a client of a psychotherapist. We actually want the to be dealt on a common basis, on the equal basis.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. But obviously, you know, Cameron's engagement with, you know, Prime Minister Medvedev and then President Medvedev and then President Putin predates, you know, the onset of the Ukraine crisis. And there are other issues to talk about at that time, you know, where we had a mutual interest. Increasingly, kind of Syria became on the horizon, and there were kind of good discussions on that, although that then kind of fell apart after the kind of Westminster parliamentary debate, which moved against and UK military involvement in Syria. Obviously, Litvinenko, there were some disagreements on that. But nevertheless, you know, despite the differences on some policy issues, there was a real intent to move forward on, you know, some more positive areas of engagement on counterterrorism. You know, for example, Cameron was really sincere, actually, believe it or not, in wanting to see a really successful and safe, you know, Olympic Games in Sochi at the start of 2014. And a lot of effort went into that before the kind of Ukraine crisis really started. Cameron visited President Putin in Sochi. So, I mean, these were genuine efforts. And of course, you can't agree on everything. That's impossible and not realistic. We don't agree on everything with the US, for example, or other kind of European partners. But there was a real desire to kind of collaborate in areas where it made sense for us to do so and where that's possible.
Now, since we mentioned Putin's first visit to the UK, let me ask you about the last, at least until now, and it was in 2013 within the framework of G8, in which you played a major organizing role. What do you remember from that event?
Well, I mean, I remember that kind of the mood music was really good between Cameron and Putin. It wasn't actually that long after, you know, Cameron's visit to Sochi to talk about Syria and other things, and not long after actually that the meeting in Northern Ireland. Obviously, David Cameron went to St. Petersburg for the G20 summit, and there were some real areas of parallel sort of cooperation alignment on policy on G8 and G20 issues, particularly around tax transparency and things like that. So, you know, there's some really good areas of collaboration there on G20 kind of policy portfolios. Putin was very welcome in Northern Ireland at that time. I literally kind of saw him up close and personal myself a couple of locations on the site. It was a different time, but obviously overshadowing that was some pretty bad mood music between Putin and Obama, which kind of possibly got more of the headlines at the time because of their...
Absolutely. Can I ask you about that? Because this is something that stands out the most for me, and not so much in substantive terms, but in emotional terms, because we all remember that footage of Obama seeing in a very demonstratively bored and some would say arrogant fashion on the podium across a nonchalant Putin. And maybe it's just the Russian bias, but I think there is a strong perception in Russia that the West sort of maintains its moral grandiosity at Russia's expense, that Obama sort of had to meet with Putin by duty, but he was virtue signaling that he is morally above it. How common do you think that is for the West in general of using Russia as a scapegoat for its own shadow?
I mean, I think it's certainly true in the West, we take many policymakers take a very normative view on policy that, you know, we don't engage with Russia because we don't sort of like Russia's actions in this or that sphere, particularly in the context of Ukraine, but on other issues as well, relationships with Iran and so on and so forth, without necessarily shining a lens back on their own countries. And I think that's a bit of a challenge. But I think actually that and I think the same could be said about sort of how the Russian media portrays, you know, the West. That's very much reinforced by the media, where it's, you know, it's very difficult to have a counter argument to that kind of line, in the UK, much as, you know, state controlled media in Russia very much pushes the Russians to the political line.
Well, that's not necessarily true, well, because I work for a state-supported television, and I'm giving you here the ability to say whatever you want to say.
This is very true, and I'm grateful to you for that. But no, the point I'm making is that it's very difficult to have a counter-argument to the really entrenched line about Russia, and that entrenchment has become worse over the past decade that I've seen since I've been involved in working with Russia. That's very much true. It's very, you know, given how much we talk to other countries about the need for free speech, it's amazing how difficult it is to express an alternative view on our policy towards Russia.
Well, Mr. Proud, before we get engaged or rather entrenched in our own argument, let's take a short break, but we will be back in a couple of moments. Stay tuned.
очень переживаю за военных, которые погибают, но они достойны защищать нашу Родину.
По нам начали стрелять украинские, мне ногу ранили. Вот так вот аж. Да чуть-чуть остался шрам.
Фашисты первые наступали на нашу землю, а мы защищали ее, терпели, погибали. Но они все равно идут до победы.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ian Proud, a former British diplomat and author of A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy Failed in Russia. Now, Mr. Proud, in the book, you describe yourself as a realist and you maintain that the core purpose of diplomacy and indeed statesmanship is to manage relationship between states and to prevent conflict. Are you sure that this is still an authentically pursued goal of the UK policy? Because it does seem from Moscow, not just in Ukraine, but also in the Middle East, for example, that Britain benefits from sparking conflicts rather than solving them.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that we sparked conflict in the Middle East, but I think the critical point is what we're doing to try and bring an end to conflicts around the world. And there, I think, you know, our actions could leave us vulnerable to some criticism, particularly in Gaza, you know, where we've been quite slow in pushing for a ceasefire there and in a very caveated way. And likewise in Ukraine, where I don't think we once actually sort of encouraged a ceasefire there, despite the ongoing devastation and destruction to be caused in that country. So I think, you know, there actually, I think there's a need for greater realism in our approach to both zones of conflict. But I don't think it would be fair to say we cause either conflict.
When I ask that question, I do not ask it in a sort of in a moralistic sense. I ask it as a matter of strategy and tactics. And I do that also with an experience of being a reporter on the ground in Syria, in Libya. And frankly, I mean, it's hard to process the British role in those conflicts and say that it was very transparent and moral. And that's why I'm asking you about this, because I think it's essentially about positioning of Britain within the Western camp. What role do you think Britain wants to play and what means it's using? Because clearly it could not be the alpha player. That role is reserved for Washington. So what is left there for Britain to exert its power, to maintain its influence, and also to gain what it wants to gain within the Western camp?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a bit of an identity crisis at the moment in the UK about what our role should be, because certainly since Brexit, you know, we were determined to break free and take back control of our lives through Brexit. And it seems to me that one of the biggest consequences of Brexit is that on foreign policy terms, we've simply drifted to closer alignment with the US. And, you know, we've passed control of our foreign policy to, in some respects, maybe not all, but to Washington. So I think we're in a bit of an identity crisis. And you see that very much in terms of the approach we're taking on Gaza and on Ukraine, where our policy is you know, very closely aligned with the American policy, although splits between us and the US are now starting to emerge in Ukraine. But nevertheless, you know, I think we have to make sense of what our role is in the world as an essentially European country. I know we don't like to talk about being European, but we are, you know, a European sort of country, and how we can work better with European partners to bring about European peace and security.
I want to ask you about what's going on within, not necessarily Gaza, but within the whole Middle East today, because it's pretty clear that, for example, the United States and Iran do not want to get involved into a direct conflict. But there's sort of perception, and I heard it from both the Americans and the Iranians, that there's some third forces that are trying to capitalize on the insecurities of both sides and are essentially trying to get whatever they can salvage from the American globalist heritage. The Americans are withdrawing back to themselves. They're pulling production back to the United States. And there's some remnants of the globalist economy, some of them concentrated around London, that may be beneficial for the UK to preserve. Do you think UK may be involved in something like this, playing not only against its proclaimed enemies like Russia, for example, Iran, but also against its supposed allies like the United States?
It does. No, I don't think so. I think that's kind of a pie in the sky, to be perfectly honest, to use an English kind of saying. I think the problem with Gaza, and actually the same problem with Ukraine, is that we're not taking a position on the conflict that actually recognizes the need for a solution that works for both sides. A solution that works for the Palestinian people that are being subject to all sorts of terrible, frankly, attacks and injustices and human rights violations, and the works of the Israeli people that suffered that dreadful kind of terrorist attack in October of last year. We need, as if we want to have a role as statespeople, we need to kind of take a view that tries to reconcile the different positions of Palestine and Israel, and try and find some sort of long-term solution in concert with our international partners. And exactly the same can be said with the conflict in Ukraine, where we clearly side with Ukraine, we'll support Ukraine for as long as it takes, apparently, although it now seems to be taking too long, according to some sort of Western partners. But actually, what we need to be doing is long-term promoting a more sort of productive relationship between Ukraine and Russia, between the West and Ukraine and Russia, and so on, rather than taking sides. I think it's the taking sides in conflicts, which is actually one of the big problems that we face in terms of our credibility as international kind of diplomats.
Let me ask specifically about this special relationship between Washington and London. And as we all know, anyone who's ever been in a marital relationship, any special relationship has its fair share of resentment and sometimes even concealed sabotage. How would you describe at this point of time, authentically, the ties between London and Washington? What is there beyond the public facade and the public proclamations of eternal union and eternal friendship?
Well, we do have a good relationship with the US, but it's a relationship
But
that's
it's
very much
in that
driven.
relationship. You yourself said that your identity is lost. You are not getting what you want. You're getting a sort of a short stick, a short end of a
Yeah,
stick of this
I
relationship.
get that. But what I was going on to say, it's a relationship in the context of an economy that's 10 times bigger than our economy, a military that's kind of 10 times bigger than our military, and so on. So, we are very much the junior partner in the relationship. And I certainly think we're made to feel the junior partner. The US hasn't rushed can sign a free trade agreement with us after Brexit, but nevertheless, they're happy to have us kind of helping them do rocket attacks against Houthi rebels and so on, in the Middle East. So, I mean, I think it's a very uneven relationship. But I mean, I like the US. I've got American friends, like I've got Russian friends. I
Think
should be
about
friends with
liking.
anyone.
Come on,
I
we
mean,
are
it's an unequal
discussing
relationship.
serious issues. We are discussing actually national treasures and the way you deal with those treasures in a responsible way. And I heard you say once that you believe that Americans, at the end of the day, are always transactional. And perhaps it's not bad to be transactional because it's, minding what you are trying to achieve. Do you think the UK policy would benefit from being a little bit more transactional and openly so?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and certainly you look at our policy towards China, for example, which bizarrely is totally opposite from our policy towards Russia, which appears to be that we just don't really engage with Russia at a political level, for a decade. But with China, despite the kind of quite significant differences of opinion on various issues, we nevertheless recognise the value in engagement, so that we can have those kind of growing discussions to kind of deconflict. It's we need to be able to do that. We need to be able to have relationships that take the good with the bad, that recognize that differences exist, but still are able to have kind of grown conversations at the level of leadership to allow that to happen.
Now, going to the Ukrainian conflict, I think we would both agree that at the crux of it is the proposition of NATO expansion, which Russia has seen and still sees as a core strategic threat. And what I think is far more important, it has the weapons, the strategy, and the political resolve to defend against what it sees as a threat. And yet, as you have observed, the UK, together with the US, have refused to acknowledge Russia's sensibilities or its ability to, defend what it deems to be its strategic interest. What exactly did they fail to see? The Russia's concerns, which were numerously voiced, or the troops that Russia had assembled on the border in 2021?
you know, we had the experience from 2008 with the war in Georgia that was, you know, prompted by a very similar kind of set of circumstances. I mean, ultimately, in the West, we should be looking for a future for Ukraine that, that is more prosperous than now, that is more integrated with the global economy and so on and so forth. I don't think NATO expansion personally is consistent with that idea, particularly when Russia is so kind of resolutely opposed, opposed to that expansion. That's not new news. We've known about it for well over a decade, and yet we continue to push this line. I think, you know, if we get to the point, hopefully this year or maybe next year, where we have a ceasefire in Ukraine, we really will need to have clarity about that aspiration and be more realistic about it for Ukraine's benefit, frankly. And interestingly, actually, kind of Zelensky himself, back in March of 2022, just a month after the war had started, was showing signs of kind of being willing to concede on NATO membership. You know, there's definite frustration you could see in Ukrainian kind of governmental circles that actually, you know, they wanted NATO to close the skies over Ukraine. They wanted more NATO kind of direct military intervention, and NATO wasn't getting involved. And you could sense that palpable feeling of rejection from Ukraine that despite all these assurances that you can maybe join us one day, we're not actually going to kind of come to your aid when the fighting starts. And so he opened a slight window to kind of concession on possible neutrality with security assurances and that sort of thing, and that was then taken off the table. Well, and
ultimately, it's up to him to decide. I mean, he has all the constitutional powers to decide on his country neutrality. But when you keep referring to doing or being responsible for Ukraine's sake, I wonder if you are still in this UK's position of sort of moral grandiosity. Shouldn't you do that for your own sake? Because, I mean, does the UK have the resources available, this strategy to actually support NATO enlargement? Do you have the tanks, the weapons, the people to fight against Russia in order to implement that as a policy goal?
Well, hopefully you're not finding me too grandiose, Oksana. I'm certainly not finding you too grandiose. But I mean, I think my view is that actually, it's not a bad thing to want a safe and prosperous Ukraine in the future. That involves
reevaluation. What about yourself? I mean, you keep talking about Ukraine.
That involves reevaluation of our policy on NATO. But on your specific point, I mean, NATO, not including the US, NATO armies in Europe, as twice as large as Russia's army. So, I mean,
it's not able to produce enough munitions to support Ukraine. I mean, you can be fat, as, you know, some people in America are fat, but they're not strong. I mean, aren't we confusing the size with the real strength here? Because it's ultimately about efficiency of applying your resources in a resultful way. Can NATO do that at this point of time?
The point is that NATO has never wanted a direct conflict with Russia and Ukraine, but unfortunately, kind of because the idea of NATO expansion has remained on the table, we've ended up in this kind of halfway house where, you know, we neither want to kind of engage with Russia and listen to Russia's concerns, but neither are we willing to actually fight for Ukraine to actually kind of hold on to that position of NATO aspiration. And this really comes to the core a point that we need to have a final reckoning on. Well, what is a peaceful Ukraine's future status? What does that look like in terms of its NATO aspirations, its EU membership aspirations, and so on and so forth? We finally have to kind of grip that if we really are serious as outsiders, not invested directly in the conflict, in wanting to see peace in Ukraine.
Okay. Well, Mr. Proud, it's been a great pleasure for me talking to you. Sorry for becoming a little bit feisty to the end. I guess our viewers can get where this historical animosity takes root in, but it's been a great pleasure.
I don't have any animosity, but yes, it's good that we're able to talk about it.
The pleasure was on my side as well. Thank you very much. And thank you to our viewers for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.